Chapter 25 Silent Thunder. It had a formal name in the records of the Pentagon, but to the people who invented it, the people who built it, and the people who sent it on its way, it was called Silent Thunder. In the dark of midnight, Silent Thunder took off from its birthplace, which was in the old Boeing field outside of Seattle, Washington, and cruised westward at a leisurely 1,000 kilometers an hour. The choice of darkness wasn't to keep it from being seen by some enemy. That would have been impossible. Every conceivable enemy, and everybody else as well, owned a sky full of observation satellites, and those were watching everybody's every move. But it was still dark when, several hours later, Silent Thunder completed its great circle crossing of the Pacific Ocean and dropped, like a rock, its pilot said later, almost to sea level. There it slid over the waters between the islands of Honshu and Hokkaido and entered the Sea of Japan. It was then that the darkness became an advantage to the people who ran Silent Thunder. Darkness meant no nosy newscasters on one of the Japanese islands would get a good look at it, and therefore news of it would not be showing up at everybody's breakfast table. The radars belonging to Japan's tiny armed forces in Aomori and Hakodate did light up, of course. They didn't matter. Japan didn't have enough weaponry to do anything about something like Silent Thunder. Anyway, 12 hours earlier, the Japanese generals had been notified, in strict secrecy, that America would be sending an experimental aircraft around there, and it would be courteous of them to look the other way. Once well into the Sea of Japan, Silent Thunder climbed again, leveling off at 12,000 meters. Of course, the western shores of the sea were Russian, and of course the radars there were a lot more numerous and powerful than Japan's. They didn't matter either. Russian top brass, too, knew that Silent Thunder was no threat. That is, to them. When its pilot and navigator agreed that they had reached their aiming point, Silent Thunder slowed to just enough velocity to keep it in the air and began to deploy its armaments. Those armaments, a modest-yield nuclear bomb and a hollow copper tube no wider than a man's body, would have baffled the weapons specialists of even a decade earlier, but they were all Silent Thunder needed to do its job. Inside the weapons guidance system, a map of the adorable leader's North Korea appeared, overlaid by the long, narrow oval that was the footprint of the weapon. No human being in Silent Thunder looked at that map, because no human being was there. Its captain, all of its crew, was back in Washington State, observing the map on a TV screen. "It looks all right to me," the pilot, an American, said to the bombardier, who happened to be Russian. "Deploy the masks." "Right," said the bombardier, fingers on his keypad. Black shapes formed around the edges of the oval, tracing the course of the Yalu River on its north and west, the demarcation line that was the border with South Korea, and then the Pacific coast to the south and east. Those shapes were nothing tangible, of course. Nothing made of matter could have survived what they needed to mask off, and devising the electronic fields that could do the mask's job had been one of the trickiest parts of building Silent Thunder. "All set," the bombardier reported to the pilot. "Position still okay?" the pilot asked the Chinese navigator, and when the navigator reported that it was, the pilot crossed himself. He thought of himself as a lapsed Catholic, but there were times when he didn't feel lapsed at all. "Fire the weapon," he ordered the bombardier. And for the first time in the history of the world, a nation lost a war, totally, irrevocably lost it, without anyone getting hurt. Actually, that wasn't quite true. A few heart patients in the adorable leader's domain did die. They were the ones who were unlucky enough to be wearing pacemakers when the electromagnetic blast struck, carrying more energy than a stroke of lightning. But about the only North Koreans with access to any technology that expensive, that Western, were high-ranking officials. They weren't missed. Oh, and there were a handful of unfortunates flying in light planes who did not survive the consequent crashes, as high-ranking as the others, and no more mourned. In all, the latest regime change in North Korea came about with far fewer casualties than an average holiday weekend on the Western world's highways. In a fraction of a second, All the adorable leader's telephone systems were disabled. Most of his power lines were short-circuited. Every weapon his nation owned that was any more complex than a shotgun would fire no more. And the adorable leader's North Korean nation had owned a vast number of weapons of all kinds. Without telephones or radios, no one knew what was happening any farther away than a shout could be heard. The nation was no longer a threat to anyone, because no real nation existed anymore on that plot of ground. There was, it is true, one small actual battle in this non-war. That was because of one obdurate colonel stationed outside of Kaesong. He could not, of course, understand what had happened, but at least he recognized that his army was at risk. He did what many colonels would have done. He fell out his command, issued them whatever rifles and pistols would fire, and launched them on an attack across the line. It didn't get very far. It didn't even get them all the way through the dense minefields that bracketed the demarcation line. Half a dozen of his frontline soldiers fell when mines went off, a score more as the South Korean troops on the south side of the line saw them coming and opened fire, and then ceased fire again when they saw that the North Koreans were still coming forward, but slowly and cautiously now, and with their hands above their heads. By then, of course, the whole world was beginning to learn what was going on, and not just our own world, either. The rest of the galaxy heard the electronic roar of that weapon only as it reached them by the sluggish crawl, a mere 300,000 kilometers. Old-fashioned people and Americans still said 186,000 miles per second of the velocity of light. The 1.5's armada, being 15 light-years from Earth at the time of the blast, eventually crossed paths with the roar, which they detected had originated from those very beings they were on their way to annihilate. No one on Earth knew that, of course. Contrarywise, no one among the machine-stored or any other part of the hegemony of the Grand Galactics knew what had just occurred in North Korea either. Therefore, when they heard that raucous electronic belch, they drew some reasonable but wrong conclusions. It took years for that electromagnetic white noise to get to the home planets of any of the races subject to the Grand Galactics, especially to that wrinkle in dark matter flows that was home to the nearest cluster of the Grand Galactics themselves, and it had a bad effect. Potentially, indeed, it could have been a tragically, even terminally, bad one. The difficulty was the nature of the weapon its owners called Silent Thunder. Most human weapons were not a problem, since they depended either on chemical explosions or nuclear ones for their effect. Such puny events caused no fear in the non-baryonic Grand Galactics. Silent Thunder, however, was a different kettle of particles. It could endanger parts of the Grand Galactic's own armorarium. Not, of course, the trivial early version that had just put the adorable leader out of business, but the more advanced specimens that these pesky humans were bound to come up with before long, if they were allowed to. Of course, they weren't going to be allowed to. Their total annihilation was already on the schedule. When it had taken place, the problem would no longer exist. Which meant, in the famous old words of William Schwenk Gilbert, as Coco explains his transgression to the Mikado, when an order is given, it's as good as done. So actually, it is done. Up until that point, the question of the wiping out of the human race had been, in some sense, not totally resolved. That is, the Grand Galactics themselves, having given the order, had continued checking up on the situation because of the remote possibility that circumstances would change and they might want to cancel the order. They did that no more. They saw no reason to go on bothering their heads, that is, if they had had heads, with this particular question. So they erased it from their consciousness, or consciousnesses, in favor of more urgent and certainly more entertaining matters. High on that list were, one, a white dwarf star just on the point of stealing enough matter from its red giant partner to go type 1A supernova, two, some communications from their opposite numbers in other galaxies that needed at least to be acknowledged, and three, the question of whether to split off another bill-like fraction of themselves to pay closer attention to the small and fast-moving minor galaxy whose orbit would cause the galaxy to crash into their own at any moment now, Well, within the next 4 or 5 million years at the latest. Very low on their list was anything that might remind them of that nasty little planet that its occupants called Earth. Why should they care? All of this was not, after all, an unprecedented experience for the Grand Galactics. In the thousands of millions of years since they had become, willy-nilly, the overlords of that part of the universe, they had encountered some 254 similarly dangerous races and terminated some 251 of them. The other three, whose offenses were marginal, were given another chance. It was not likely that the humans of Earth would become a fourth. Chapter 26. On the Threshold of Peace. Back on Earth, there was confusion and worry. A mostly joyful confusion, to be sure, because hardly anybody in the world objected to the fact that the adorable leader, with his shyness and winsome apologetic public proclamations and, oh yes, his million-man-strong army with all its rockets and nukes, was history. But questions were asked. By what right had America destroyed another country, and how the devil had they accomplished it? No one answered. The American government merely said that the matter was under review and a statement would be issued, but didn't say when. Military scientists around the world wished they had the wreckage of Silent Thunder to study. They didn't, though. All that was left of Silent Thunder was a haze of white-hot liquid metal particles rapidly cooling. The news services were doing their best. Within an hour of when Silent Thunder had done its snuffing out of the adorable leader's North Korea, newscopters from South Korea and Japan were circling over the now electronically silent land. There was nothing to hear, but much to see. Their cameras picked up the crowds milling around in the vast and normally deserted avenues of Pyongyang, or the smaller groups that stood helplessly beside their unworkable aircraft at now useless Air Force bases, or the even tinier groups that sometimes could not control their rage and confusion and took it out by firing their impotent arms at the interlopers. Some of those cameras picked up other things. A few detected other helicopters, for instance, also circling out of range of any persons with hand weapons. These other aircraft came from the same cities as the news reporters. Their mission, however, was not to observe. It was to inform. Every one of them was equipped with powerful loudspeakers, and each loudspeaker was manned by a former North Korean refugee. Each of them circled over the towns and neighborhoods they had come from, and each speaker introduced himself by name as he repeated his, or her, four-part message. The reign of the so-called adorable leader is over. He will be tried for the crimes of betraying, mistreating, and starving a whole generation of our people. The North Korean army is now disbanded. It serves no useful purpose. No one is going to attack you. And all soldiers are now free to return to their homes and resume their peacetime occupations. Ample supplies of food and other necessities are on their way to you right now. Every one of you from this day forward is guaranteed for life a diet adequate for health and growth. Finally, you now will have the right to choose by secret ballot who will govern you. And to that, many of the broadcasters added, often with tears running down their cheeks, "And I am coming home." Chapter 27. Pax per fidem. Gamini didn't keep his colleagues waiting for clarification. Not more than 36 hours anyway, and for that particular length of time they, like the rest of the world, had plenty to keep them occupied. It wasn't work that obsessed them. It was the media with their unending scenes of outside forces pouring in, unopposed and nearly unarmed, too, unless you counted their noisemakers and shock-givers, moving in on the previously impregnable fortress that had been the adorable leader's North Korea. Add to that the still more endless chatter of guess and supposition and bafflement that every commentator had to offer. Then, at last, something appeared on the screen that at least promised to give some answers. It was after dinner, and also after Myra had taken her turn at putting the baby to bed, that Ranjit again snapped on the TV. A moment later he gave a yelp of surprise that brought her back into the room.
"Look," he said, "maybe we're going to get some real information."
What the TV was displaying was an Asian-looking man who stood before a lectern. No one introduced him. He simply began to speak. "Hello," he said, voice educated and quite unflustered at being before the cameras. "My name is Aritsune Meyuda, and at one time I was Japan's ambassador to the United Nations. Now I am what I think you would call the personnel director for what we have been calling Pax Per Fidem. That's short for Pax In Orbe Terrarum Per Fidem, or World Peace Through Transparency. We are the ones who are responsible for the events on the Korean Peninsula. Because that operation had to be conducted in secrecy, there has been much speculation about it and about what has gone on there since. We can now supply some answers for you. To explain how those events came about and what they mean, the person who made them all possible will speak."
Mayuda's face disappeared from the screen, replaced by the image of a tall, bronzed, and aged but strongly built figure, the sight of whom produced a gasp from Myra.
"Oh, my God," she said. That's...
But before she got it out, Mayuda was already introducing him.
"I give you," he said, "the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Rounui Thierry."
Rounui Thierry troubled no more with prefacing remarks than had Mayuda.
"Let me begin," he said, "by giving every one of you my assurance that nothing improper has occurred in Korea. This was not a war of conquest. It was a necessary police action approved by a secret but unanimous vote of the United Nations Security Council. To explain how this came about, I would like to clear up a matter that dates from a few years ago. Many of you will remember that at that time there was much discussion about the way in which the three most powerful nations in the world, that is, Russia, China, and the United States, were attempting to arrange a superpower conference with the laudable stated aim of finding a solution to the many little wars that were breaking out all around the world. Many commentators thought that what then happened was ludicrous, even shameful, because of a story that was given out. The rumor was that their plan fell apart because the three nations could not agree on the city in which to hold the conference. In truth, however, I must now tell you that that whole episode was a deception. That was done at my request. It was needed to conceal the fact that the three presidents were actually conducting highly secret meetings on a subject of transcendental importance. Their subject was simply how, and when, and indeed whether, to employ a new, non-lethal, but powerfully destructive weapon, the one which we all now know by the name Silent Thunder. What caused them to take this exceptional action was that each of them had learned through their quite effective intelligence services that both of the other states had developed a Silent Thunder-like weapon and were rushing to make it operational. And all three of the presidents had advisers who were urging them to be the first to complete the development of the weapon, and then to use it to destroy the economies of their two adversaries and thus become the world's only superpower again. To their everlasting credit, they all rejected that plan. In their secret meetings, they agreed to turn Silent Thunder over to the United Nations.
He was somberly silent for a moment. A big and imposing man, said once to have been the strongest man on Moruputi, the tiny French Polynesian island where he had been born. Then he smiled.
"And they did," he announced. "And so the world was spared a terrible conflict with unguessable results."
By then Myra and Ranjit were giving each other startled looks almost as much as they were watching the screen. That was not the end of it. There was a great deal more, and, sleep deferred, indeed forgotten, they kept on listening. For nearly an hour, actually. For all the time Secretary General Thierry was speaking, and then for the much longer time when all the world's political commentators went over every word of it in their own debates. and by the time Ranjit and Myra were preparing for bed, they were still trying to make sense of it.
"So what Thierry did," Ranjit called while brushing his teeth, "was to organize this Pax per Fidem thing with its people from 20 different countries."
"And all of them neutral ones," Myra pointed out from where she was fluffing up the pillows on their bed.
"And not only that, but they were all island nations that weren't big enough to be a threat to anybody else anyway."
Ranjit thoughtfully rinsed his mouth.
"Actually," he said, drying his face, "when you look at the results, all of that doesn't sound all that bad, does it?"
"Not really," Myra conceded. "It's true that North Korea has always seemed to be a threat to world peace." Ranjit stared at his reflection in the mirror.
"Ah, well," he said at last.
"If Gamini's coming, I wish he'd get here."
When Gamini did get there, he bore flowers for Myra, a giant Chinese rattle for the baby, a bottle of Korean whiskey for Ranjit, and a full load of apologies.
"Sorry I took so long," he said, kissing Myra chastely on the cheek and sparing a hug for Ranjit. "I didn't mean to leave you hanging, but I was in Pyongyang with my father, just checking to see that it was all going all right, and then we had to make a quick trip to Washington. The president's mad at us."
Ranjit looked immediately concerned.
"Mad? How? Are you saying he didn't want you people to attack?"
"Oh, of course not. Nothing like that. The thing was that right along the border, at one stretch that was kind of kinky because of the terrain, there happened to be a couple of hectares of U.S. and South Korean defense materiel that got just as wiped out as the North stuff."
He shrugged.
"We couldn't help it, you know. Old Adorable had a lot of his meanest armaments right on his side of the line, and it's a pretty narrow line. We had to make sure we got it all. The president knows that, of course, but somebody made the mistake of guaranteeing him that nothing American would be touched. Meanwhile, there's about $14 billion worth of America's deadliest high-tech that doesn't work anymore. And Ranj, are you ever going to open that bottle?"
Ranjit, who had been regarding his boyhood chum with unalloyed wonder, obeyed while Myra collected glasses. As he poured, Ranjit said, "Does that mean trouble?"
"Oh, not enough to worry about. He'll get over it. And listen, while he's what we're talking about, he gave me something to hand to you."
That something was an envelope embossed with the White House official seal. When they had all been served and Ranjit had taken his first sip and made a face, he opened the letter. It said, "Dear Mr. Subramanian, on behalf of the people of the United States, I thank you for your service. I must now relieve you of your present post, however, and ask you to take on an even more important one, which, I am afraid, entails even more secrecy."
"He signed it with his own hand, too," Gamini said proudly. "Didn't use one of those machines. I saw him do it."
Ranjit set down the unfinished part of his drink, the part that was going to remain unfinished forever, and said,
"Gamini, how much of this show are you personally running?"
Gamini laughed.
"Me? Hardly any. I'm an errand boy for my father. He tells me what to do, and I do it. Like helping recruit the Nepalese."
"Which I've been wanting to ask you about," Myra said, tactfully sniffing the whiskey's bouquet without actually tasting any of it.
"Why Nepalese?"
"Well, two reasons. First, their great-grandfathers used to serve in the British Army. They were called the Gurkhas, and they were about the toughest and smartest soldiers they had. And the most important part, just look at them. Nepalese don't look a bit like Americans or Chinese or Russians, so everybody in North Korea wasn't trained from birth to hate them."
He sniffed his whiskey, sighed, and put it down.
"They're like you and me, Ranj," he added. "One reason we can be so useful to Pax per Fidem. So what about it? Can I sign you up tonight?"
"Tell us more," Myra said quickly before Ranjit had a chance to speak. "What would you want Ranjit to do?" Gamini grinned.
"Well, not what we were going to offer you way back when. What I was thinking of then was that you could help me be an assistant to my father, but you weren't famous then."
"But now?" Myra prompted.
"Actually, we'll have to work that out," Gamini confessed. "You'd go to work for the council, and they would probably have some request to make of you. Speak for them at press conferences, sell the idea of Pax per Fidem to the world."
Ranjit gave his friend a mock frown that was not entirely imitation.
Wouldn't I have to know more about it to do that?
Kamini sighed.
Good old Ranjit, he said. I was hoping you'd see the light and sign up right away, but yes, I suppose that you being you, you certainly would need to know more. So, I brought some reading for you.
He reached into his briefcase and pulled out an envelope of papers.
Let's call this your homework, Ranj. I guess the best thing would be for you to read it, both of you, and talk it over tonight, and then tomorrow I'll come by to take you to breakfast, and then I'll ask you the big question.
And what question is that? Ranjit asked.
Why, whether you want to help us save the world. What did you think?
Natasha got a little less playtime that night than she was used to. She gave her parents a few little wails to show that she had noticed the lack, but 2 minutes later she was asleep, and Myra and Ranjit could go back to studying their homework. There were two sets of papers. One seemed to be a sort of proposed constitution for, they supposed, the land that had formerly been the North Korea of one dictator or another. Both Ranjit and Myra read it attentively, of course, but most of it was procedural stuff, like the American Constitution that both had read in school. Not entirely like the American, though. There were several paragraphs unlike anything in that document. One stated that the country would never go to war under any circumstances. That sounded more like the post-World War II Japanese constitution the Americans had written for them. Another wasn't in any constitution they had ever heard of before. It described some rather unusual methods of selecting their office holders that involved heavy usage of computers. And a third pledged that every institution in the country, including not just their government legislatures at all levels, but educational, scientific, and even religious institutions, had to permit access of observers at all of their functions.
I guess that's the transparency Gamini was talking about, Ranjit observed.
The other document was about more tangible things. It described how the Secretary General, with maximum secrecy, had set about creating his 20-member independent council to run Pax per Fidem. It listed the members, ranging from the Bahamas, Brunei, and Cuba, to Tonga and Vanuatu, with Sri Lanka tucked in just before. And it was a little more specific about the concept of transparency. In the interests of this transparency, Pax per Fidem was charged to create an independent inspectorate for which the organization was pledged to offer that same transparency.
I guess that inspectorate would be where you would go, Myra said as they turned the light out.
Ranjit yawned.
Maybe so. But I'm going to need a clearer picture of what I'd be supposed to do before I say I'll do it.
The next morning, Gamini did his best to answer all their questions. I talked to my father a little bit about how much freedom you'd have. It's a lot, Ranj. He's sure that you could go anywhere in Pax per Fidem and see anything we're doing, with the single exception of anything to do with Silent Thunder. You won't know how many of the weapons we have, or what we'd like to do with them, because nobody below the council itself will. But anything else, sure, you can sit in on most council meetings, and if you've seen anything that you think is wrong, you can report it to them.
And just suppose, Myra said, that he did see something wrong, and the council didn't do anything to fix it.
Then he would be free to tell the world's press about it, Gamini said promptly. That's what transparency is all about. So what do you say? Any other questions before you say if you'll join us?
A few, Ranjit said mildly. This council, they meet, right? And what do they talk about when they do?
Well, Gamini said, it's mostly planning for every contingency. You don't do a regime change without making sure the population has a viable society left after the change. We learned that from Germany after 1918 and Iraq after 2003. And it's not just making sure the population has its food and as soon as possible its electrical power and its working police force to prevent looting and so on. It's giving them a chance at forming their own government. And of course there's the future. There are plenty of brushfire wars and threats of war going on, and the council keeps an eye on all of them.
Wait a minute, Myra said. Are you talking about doing that Silent Thunder thing in other parts of the world?
Gamini gave her a fond smile.
Dear Myra, he said, whatever made you think we were going to stop with North Korea?
Then taking notice of the expressions on their faces, he sounded hurt.
What's the matter? You aren't saying you don't trust us, are you?
It was Myra who answered, or more exactly, responded, because it certainly was not a specific answer to Gamini's specific question. Gamini, did you ever happen to read the book 1984? It was published in England around the middle of the last century by a man named George Orwell.
Gamini looked offended.
Of course I read it. My father was a big Orwell fan. Are you trying to suggest we sound like Big Brother? Because don't forget the Secretary General had the unanimous approval of the Security Council for everything we did.
That's not what I mean, dear Gamini. What I'm thinking about is the way Orwell had the world divided in his book. There were only three powers because they'd conquered everything else.
Oceania, by which Orwell meant mostly America, Eurasia, that was Russia, then still the Soviet Union, and East Asia, China.
Now Gamini was visibly annoyed. Now really, Myra, you don't think that the countries that created Pax Perfidem are going to try to divide the world among them, do you?
And again Myra replied with a question of her own. What any of them are planning, I don't know, Gamini. I hope that's not it. But if they were, what could stop them?
And when Gamini was gone, still a friend, a very dear friend, but now a friend they would not be seeing very often, Ranjit turned to his wife.
So, he said, what do we do now?
The president has fired me from the job here. I've turned down the job he and Gamini wanted me to take.
He frowned at a thought.
His father wanted me to take it too, he added. I imagine he's not happy that I turned it down. I wonder if that offer of a job at the university is still open.
Chapter 28 Making a Life. Well, the job was. Whatever faults Dr. Datusena Bandara might be charged with, vindictiveness was not among them. The university would be delighted to welcome Dr., if only honorary, Ranjit Subramanian to the faculty as a full and tenured professor with his employment, and thus his pay, to begin at once, actual work to start when the professor found it quite convenient. More than that, the university would be pleased to find a faculty position for Dr., this time not honorary but fully earned, Myra de Souza Subramanian as well. Of course, it went without saying her title wouldn't be as elevated as her husband's,